Opera Audio presents The Measure of a Man, written and read by Sidney Poitier. Many years ago, I wrote a book about my life, which was, necessarily, in large part, a book about my life in Hollywood. More recently, I decided that I wanted to write a book about life, just life itself. What I've learned by living more than 70 years of it, what I've absorbed through my early experiences in a certain time and place, and what I absorbed, certainly without knowing it, through the blood of my parents and through the blood of their parents before them. I felt called to write about certain values, such as integrity and commitment, faith and forgiveness, about the virtues of simplicity, about the difference between amusing ourselves to death and finding meaningful pleasures, even joy. But I have no wish to play the pontificating fool, pretending that I've suddenly come up with the answers to all life's questions. Quite the contrary. I began this book as an exploration, an exercise in self-questioning. In other words, I wanted to find out, as I look back at a long and complicated life with many twists and turns, how well I've done at measuring up to the values I espouse, the standards I myself have set. Writers of a spiritual or metaphysical persuasion often convey their message through storytelling. They illustrate their points with parables drawn from great teachers of the past, whether it be Jesus of Nazareth or Buddha or the latest Arabic sage or Sufi mystic. The more exotic, the better. Some take this natural tendency to great lengths, writing whole books devoted to finding the deep wisdom embedded in ancient folktales. Psychologically complex stories drawn from Africa, Scandinavia, East Asia, Latin America, and many other far-flung traditions. They do this, it seems, to get as far away as possible from our contemporary mindset so that we can see modern, digitized, post-industrial life as if through new eyes, or perhaps through very ancient, very grounded eyes. For me, the task is much easier. First of all, I've spent a very long time working in the dream factory called Hollywood. It's been my privilege, but also my daily business, to participate in constructing and dramatizing what those of us involved always hoped were meaningful stories and putting them on the screen. Because I've always believed that my work should convey my personal values, as an author I don't have to look far to find storylines to illustrate points I wish to make. Happily, certain films that are a part of my own personal resume are also part of the collective unconscious of a great many Americans of a certain age. It's my great good fortune that many of these films, stories such as Lilies of the Field, A Patch of Blue, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and To Serve with Love, are still familiar today thanks to home video and repeated play on television. Thus, they give you and me the possibility of a common bond and a common frame of reference, and I want to use them that way. But perhaps more important, as someone wishing to make a comment or two about contemporary life and values, I don't have to dig through libraries or travel to exotic lands to arrive at a view of our modern situation refracted through the lens of the pre-industrial world or the uncommercialized, unfranchised, perhaps even unsanitized and therefore supposedly more authentic perspective of the third world. Very simply, this is because that other world, as alien as if separated by centuries in time, is the one from which I came. The Idol. It's late at night, and I lie in bed in the blue glow of the television set. I have the clicker in my hand, the remote control, and I go from 1 to 97, scrolling through the channels. I find nothing that warrants my attention, nothing that amuses me, so I scroll up again, channel by channel, from bottom to top. but already I've given it the honor of going from 1 to 97, and already I've found nothing. This vast, sophisticated technology and nothing. It's given me not one smidgen of pleasure. It's informed me of nothing beyond my own ignorance and my own frailties. But then I had the audacity to go up again, and what do I find? Nothing, of course. So, at last, filled with loathing and self-disgust, I punch the damn TV off and throw the clicker across the room, muttering to myself, "What am I doing with my time?" It's not as if I'm without other resources or material comforts, you follow. I've been very fortunate in life, and as I lie in my bed, I'm surrounded by beautiful things. Treasured books and art objects, photographs and mementos, lovely gardens on the balcony. After many years in this particular business, in this particular town, I have a rich network of friends, some only a few steps away, dozens of others whom I could reach on the phone within seconds. So, what am I doing with my time? Steeped in this foul, self-critical mood, I lie back and close my eyes, trying to empty my head of all thought. It's late. Time to sleep. So I determine to focus on that empty space in my consciousness and try to drift off. But images begin to come to me, infiltrating that darkness. Soft, sensuous images of a time very early in my life when things were so much simpler. When my options for entertainment couldn't be counted on a scale from 1 to 97. I'm on the porch of our little house on Cat Island in the Bahamas. It's the end of the day, and evening is coming on, turning the sky and the sea to the west of us a bright, burnt orange, and the sky and the sea to the east of us a cool blue that deepens to purple and then to black. In the gathering darkness, in the coolness of our porch, my mother and father sit and fan the smoke from green palm leaves they're burning to shoo away the mosquitoes and the sandflies. And as she did so often when I was small, my sister Teddy takes me in her arms to rock me to sleep. While she's rocking me in her arms, she too is fanning the smoke that comes from the big pot of green leaves being burned. And she fans the smoke around me as I try to go to sleep in her arms. That's the way the evenings always were on Cat Island. In the simplicity of that setting, I always knew how I was going to get through the day, and how Mom and Dad were going to get through the day, and how, at the end of it, we were all going to sit on this porch, fanning the smoke of the burning green leaves. On that tiny spit of land we call Cat Island, life was indeed very simple and decidedly pre-industrial. Our cultural authenticity extended to having neither plumbing nor electricity, and we didn't have much in the way of schooling or jobs either. In a word, we were poor. But poverty there was very different from poverty in a modern place characterized by concrete. It's not romanticizing the past to state that poverty on Cat Island didn't preclude gorgeous beaches and a climate like heaven. Cocoa plum trees and sea grapes and cassavas growing in the forest and bananas growing wild. Cat Island is 46 miles long and 3 miles wide, and even as a small child, I was free to roam anywhere. I climbed trees by myself at 4 and 5 years old, and 6 and 7 years old. I would get attacked by wasps, and I would go home with both eyes closed from having been stung on the face over and over. I would be crying and hollering and screaming and petrified, and my mom would take me and treat me with bush medicines from the old culture that you wouldn't believe. And then I would venture back out and go down to the water and fish alone. I would even go in sometimes and swim by myself. I had the confidence because when I was very small, my mother threw me in the ocean and watched without moving as I struggled to survive. She watched as I screamed and yelled, gulped and flailed in a panic-stricken effort to stay afloat. She watched as I clawed desperately at the water, unable to manage more than a few seconds before starting to sink beneath the surface. She watched as the ocean swallowed me second by second. Then, mercifully, my father's hand reached under, fished me out, and handed me back to my mother, who threw me back in again and again and again until she was convinced that I knew how to swim. There were snakes on the island, but none poisonous. There were black widow spiders that were poisonous, but I doubt that my parents were fearful that I would get killed by any of them. I mean, there were risks and there were hazards, but I could go anywhere, and I had myself as company. I knew from observation that the sapodilla tree produced fruit. Plump, grayish-brown, soft, juicy, and delectable, at least twice a year. And that's where the wasps' nests were that got me unexpectedly and repeatedly. I learned early that if I got up high in a sapodilla tree, rather than crawling out on limbs to see if the fruit was ripe enough to eat, I could rattle the top branches of the tree and ripe fruit would come loose from the weakened stems and fall to the ground. And then I could come down and pick it up and eat and get my belly full. I would eat until I got a belly ache, and then I would get more of my mother's bush medicine. God, awful tasting grass weeds of bitter roots and plants of which I've never known their names, and oh my goodness, chunks of aloe vera. Oh, I would have to force that stuff down my throat. And then I was off again, looking for cocoa plums, or standing on the rocks by the sea and fishing with a piece of thread and a straight pin that I had bent into a hook. I did all those things, and it was fun. Because on such an island, poverty wasn't the depressing, soul-destroying force that it can be under other circumstances. But the special beauty of Cat Island wasn't just what we had, it was also what we didn't have. Poverty notwithstanding, I was lucky, and the reason I was lucky was that I wasn't bombarded with contravening images and influences that really didn't have any direct connection to my nurturing. I didn't have to digest television, children's shows, and cartoons. I didn't have to digest the stuff on radio and have to ask, "What are they saying? They're talking about selling me something. Why are they selling me something? I don't have a job." I didn't even have to deal with the myriad stimulations that come from the presence of mechanized vehicles. No one on the island had so much as a car or motorboat. Now, if you take children in the modern United States that you and I are living in, they probably have a mom and a dad, or at least one parent, a set of grandparents possibly, and some siblings. But they're also going to have a radio in the house, and they're going to have a telephone, or at least know that such a thing exists. And they're going to know that there are television sets, and they're going to see people on the television sets who speak just like their mom and dad speak. And they're going to be familiar with motion pictures, too, because they'll start going when they're 5 or 6. They're going to see talking animals moving around like people. They're going to see animals beating up on each other and slapping each other and falling down in crevices and getting up without experiencing intense pain. Some of these animals are then going to turn around and sell them breakfast cereal. These kinds of stimulations come at today's American kids on a daily basis, but the mental and emotional apparatus for sifting through them, for processing them, for dealing with them in some meaningful way simply isn't there. But children still have to make some sense of everything they are bombarded with. They have to assume something, correctly or incorrectly, factual or otherwise. They have to encode all these distractions into the self they are slowly, day by day, building. Child psychologists have demonstrated that our minds are actually constructed by these thousands of tiny interactions during the first few years of life. We aren't just what's directed by our genes, and we certainly aren't just what we're taught. It's what we experience during these early years. A smile here, a jarring sound there, that creates the pathways and connections of the brain. We put our kids to 15 years of quick-cut advertising, passive television watching, and sadistic video games, and then we expect to see them emerge a new generation of calm, compassionate, and engaged human beings. In the kind of place where I grew up, what's coming at you is the sound of the sea and the smell of the wind and your mama's voice and the voice of your dad and the craziness of your brothers and sisters. And that's it. That's what you're dealing with when you're too young to really be counted into anything, when you're just listening, when you're watching the behavior of your siblings and your mom and dad, noting how they behave and how they attend to your feeding and how they care for you when you have a pain or when the wasp stings you around the eyes. What occurs when something goes wrong is that someone reaches out. Someone soothes. Someone protects. And as the people around you talk, you begin to recognize things that are carried on the voice. Words and behavior begin to spell out something to you. All those subtleties are what's going on with you, and that's all that's going on with you day in and day out. The rain comes and you hear the sound of it on the thatch roof and you sit waiting for it to stop because you want to go outside and play marbles. That is, play with the dried seeds from the pods of certain trees that were the marbles of my day. And if it's a Sunday, you want your mother to be able to get to the kitchen and cook the rice because you know that you always have rice on Sunday. It's very simple. The exposure of the stimuli and the stimuli are fairly natural ones, you understand? Fairly natural stimuli coming out of this family's moving from morning to night to bedtime to sleep and then get up and move from morning to night again. They work in the fields growing tomatoes. That's what my parents did when I was young. They were tomato farmers. Sometimes someone comes by with fresh fish that your parents can't put in the refrigerator because there's no such item. There's no freezer either. There isn't any electricity, so what do? They clean the fish, pack it in salt, and hang it in the sun so that it cures and dries to a consistency as stiff as boards of wood, and it stays there for months and months and months, hanging in the kitchen on a line. And when your mother needs to cook that fish, she puts it in water and soaks it, and then she puts it in a pot and cooks it, and it's as terrific as ever it was when it was fresh. On Cat Island, I was stimulated, but I wasn't bombarded. I knew how I was going to get through the day and how Mom and Dad were going to get through the day and how we were all going to sit on the porch at the end of the day together, fanning the smoke from the pot of burning leaves to shoo away the mosquitoes and the sandflies. There wasn't a paved road on Cat Island. There wasn't a telephone on Cat Island. There were no stores except for a few petty shops. So my clothes, for instance, were made out of the cloth of grain sacks. But Cat Island had plenty of paths. You walked pathways, trails that were there just because people had chosen a particular route as the quickest way for them to get from point A to point B. But most pathways were no more than maybe 3 or 4 feet wide. On either side of the 3 or 4 feet, things grew wild. There were weeds, yes, and bushes and trees, but flowers were almost everywhere, and they bloomed like crazy. There were summer flowers and flowers that responded to the weather, to the temperature, and many, like the sapodilla, that were in the habit of blooming several times a year. So, for the first 10 years of my life, the years before tomato farming failed and we moved to Nassau, I had the responsibility to a large extent of taking care of myself. Things like being stung by wasps unexpectedly even when I thought I was smart enough to dodge them or get to the fruit without disturbing the nest, and I was wrong many times, helped me to figure out some things about survival. Now I'm talking about 6, 7 years old. When I got to a place where there was danger of one kind or another, I had to make a choice. Once I knew or sensed that there was danger of one kind or another, I had to determine, what's the wisdom of proceeding? Do I withdraw? Do I try to go around? There were times when I went near rock formations at the edge of the ocean where there were high cliffs along a road on the front part of the island. And I wasn't told, but I knew by just figuring it out that if I fell over there, there was no way to climb back. So how would I manage? I was smart enough by then to know that I would have to swim, but where could I swim to where I could manage to climb up? When I walked past this place where the rocks were high, this place where I would have no chance of recovering if I jumped or fell in the water, I knew how far I would have to swim. And I knew damn well that I couldn't make that much distance swimming, so what do? I chose to stay as far away from that edge as I could. I didn't need instructions or rules for that. I had a highly sharpened instinct for survival refined by thousands of interactions with my environment. On the other hand, I had an irresistible boyhood fascination with the dark mysteries hidden behind the things I didn't understand. In the village of Arthurstown on Cat Island, there was a ditch, 100 feet long, 6 feet deep, dug from the sea to an inland salt pond. When a hand-hewn wooden trap was lifted, ocean water rushed through this ditch into the inland lake where it evaporated into salt for the use of the island's inhabitants. Since it had been dug across the roadway that ran parallel with the waterfront, the ditch was covered over with wood. 6 feet deep, at most 2 feet wide, the awesome, dark, claustrophobic aspect of this ditch was enough to scare away most of the children on the island. We were all regaled with stories about its properties as a death trap, but I found this ditch just up my alley, so to speak. It was my Mount Everest, and I planned to conquer it. One afternoon, I entered this tunnel at the salt pond end and was swallowed up by darkness as I moved towards the trapdoor that kept the ocean out. About 25 feet in, as I was beginning to get deliciously scared, I discovered that the walls were narrowing, inch by inch, and that the water was getting deeper. A little farther on, and I realized that I couldn't turn around. If I had to retreat, I would have to back out. But how fast could I move backwards if the trapdoor gave way and sent the ocean rushing at me at 50 miles an hour? With the images of moray eels and sea urchins and other spiny creatures flooding my mind, I edged towards the trapdoor. At 60 feet in, the water was too deep for me to continue crawling, so I stood up and began to wade the rest of the way. At 90 feet in, the darkness was complete. The water was up to my neck, and I was scared shitless. Too scared to back up. I was also too petrified to press on. Then I heard someone walking overhead across the wooden covering. I started to call for help, but changed my mind when I thought about the whipping in store for me if my father learned about this adventure. A moment later, whoever had been up there was gone, moving out of hearing range. While I stood there passionately regretting having undertaken this incredibly dumb thing, I became aware of the sound of the water hissing through the cracks in the trapdoor, and I realized that I was fairly close. Another 10 feet, and I would be home. Or another 10 feet, and I would be finished, depending on whether the tide was high enough to come rushing in or low enough to allow me to swim through to the rocks beyond. One way or another, I would know as soon as I reached that trapdoor and sprang it open. I inched along on tippy toes as the water grew deeper, and finally I arrived at the door in the moment of truth. I reached up with both hands and yanked on the wooden trip latch. Nothing happened. That oh shit feeling grabbed a hold of me, and I yanked again and again and again, and nothing. I didn't have the strength. I was simply too small to put enough pressure on the lever to trip the latch and open the door. This was as scared as I had ever been in my life up to that time. I started to cry and call for Mama. Dear Mama, she certainly would save me. I hollered for Mama, and I hollered, and I hollered, and I hollered, but to no avail. The only choice left open to me was to slowly retrace my steps. Too afraid even to try turning around, I began to inch my way backwards the entire 100 feet out of that ditch. The journey back was worse than the one before, nightmarish, terrifying. But I made it and quickly scurried out and up across the main road and down to the water's edge to check the tide. It was high, meaning that if I'd been able to open that trap door, my little ass would have been done for, swept at 50 miles an hour into the salt pond and buried there. I was scared so badly by that experience. It was a week before I tried it again, but this time I checked on the tide to make sure it wouldn't be running against me. By the age of 10 and a half, when I got to Nassau, which is the capital of the Bahamas and a real city, I had done much such flirting with risks and much thinking for myself. Sometimes I was right, sometimes I was wrong, and every time I was right, it strengthened something in me. By the time I reached Miami, Florida at 15, entering the modern world as an immigrant teenager, I was still a kid, and I was still thinking like a kid, but I had something inside that was looking out for me. I had an inner eye that watched the terrain and watched the circumstances, especially when I was in hostile territory. This was my education, my Cat Island curriculum. This watchful way extended to human nature, words, motivations, actions, and consequences. The quiet and simple atmosphere of my childhood enabled me to focus down to the level of the subtle body language that came to me from my parents and my siblings. On that tiny island, I had gotten to know these signals really, really well. I had learned to read them just as I had learned to read the cliffs and the tides. I didn't understand them all, but over time I could use them as a reference point in trying to understand what others were saying, what they were doing, why they were behaving towards me as they were. I think that this is the basis for what has come to be called emotional intelligence. It's a capacity that's nurtured by silence and by intimacy and by the freedom to roam. My mother, Evelyn, was a creature of silence. She was so inarticulate that she could hardly talk to anyone except my father. She couldn't speak to me much, though she communicated very eloquently in the way she cared for me, the way her spirit hovers over me to this day, her presence always around me, guiding me in ways I'm still trying to understand. My mother used to take me with her into the woods to ponds where she would do her washing. These were the days before such things as washing machines. We had no running water in the house, no electricity in the house. So when she washed clothing, and she washed the clothing for everyone in the family, she used to take it all in a big bundle into the woods, where rainwater settled into ponds. The ponds were like part of the marsh, but it would be fresh water, water you could wash clothing in. There used to be a soap called Octagon that came in an 8-sided bar. She used to use that to get the dirt in the clothing. Some people who had a few bucks, they had a scrub board, but she didn't. She would just beat the clothing on the rocks until the dirt would sort of dissolve and float out. This water wasn't hot, mind you. It was cold water. And then she would wring the water out of each item and spread the clothes on low trees to dry in the sun. We would be gone most of the days on those days when she washed. And when the clothes were almost dry, she would bundle them up and we would go back home. These were the times when she would try to talk to me. And I never gave it a thought. She was just a mother. But the question arose later in life and has persisted with me to this day. Who was this person? Even up to the day I left to go to Florida at age 15, I didn't really understand who she was. And here the dark side of me entered in. Shortly before I left, I said to her that when I got to America, I wasn't going to write to her or send her any money. That was the most hurtful thing I could say, because by long tradition in the Bahamas, that's simply what you did when you went to America. You always send back money. But hurting her is what I had set out to do, getting a little bit of revenge for something that she had done, what I don't now recall, and separating, as teenage boys need to do. But as I was leaving Nassau for good, she did a fabulous thing. My older brother, who was in Florida, was working for some white people on Miami Beach. Occasionally, he would get clothing handed down to him, and he would put it in a box and send it all to Nassau, you know, to the family. And once, in just such a box came a shirt that my mother had set aside for me. It was a shirt that I wore infrequently because it was such a nice shirt. She thought it would be wonderful, since I was leaving, if she put new buttons on it. She put on those new buttons, and she buttoned my shirt and prepared to send me off. I had never seen my mama as she was that day. In fact, she refused to go to the boat with me. She turned me over to my father, and we walked, I guess it was a good 2.5 miles to the dock, along the street on which I had spent so many of my young days. I felt such love as we walked, my love for the place and the people and their love for me. People I knew, my friends, were all along the way, and we exchanged greetings and goodbyes. One particular friend was sitting on the fence of his parents' house, and my father stopped with me and gave me a few moments to spend with my friend. We said our goodbyes, and then I continued on with my dad to the dock. As I got on the boat, he said, "Take care of yourself, son." And that was that. He sent me off to Florida, and I wouldn't see my mother or my father again for 8 years. I believe that my mother was a very special human being, and I think that much that has happened to me is the continuance of her soul and her spirit and her gift. All that she was, all that she could never articulate, that she could never say to people. Well, she felt more than she could speak. And she lived and she had children, and somehow the best of her, found its way beyond her, beyond the bounds of her own life. I feel that whatever is good in me is that energy that she was. She put it into her last child. Does that make any sense to you? I've always felt that my mother was this very pure and deserving entity, but on the level of my understanding as a youngster, she was just a mom. And she was. She was guilty of doing mom things, setting out restrictions and making demands and preventing me from making certain turns, life turns, I suppose. So when she talked to me on that level, she was a mom, from my point of view, talking to her son, especially during some of the whippings she gave me. And there were quite a few of those, and they were all different from the whippings I got from my dad. My mother's discipline was emotional. When she would get to whipping on me, it was as if she could beat into me some wisdom that she knew would be essential for my survival. I've told the story before, but I think it bears repeating here, the story of her concern at the time of my birth and her going to a soothsayer. She was rightly concerned because I was a very premature baby, born unexpectedly while my parents were traveling to Miami to sell 100 boxes of tomatoes at the produce exchange. When I arrived, weighing in at less than 3 pounds, the question was, is there enough there to take hold? My father, who had lost several children already to disease and stillbirth, was somewhat stoical about the situation. He went to a local undertaker in the colored section of Miami to prepare for my burial, coming home with a shoebox that could serve as a miniature casket. My mother, however, felt that I could be saved. One afternoon, she left the house where they were staying to visit the local palm reader and diviner of tea leaves. After some intense gazing back and forth and much silence, the soothsayer closed her eyes and took my mother's hand. There was more silence, an uncomfortably long silence. And then the soothsayer's face began to twitch. Her eyes rolled back and forth behind their lids. Strange sounds began to gurgle up from her throat. Then, all at once, her eyes flew open again. And she said, "Don't worry about your son. He will survive, and he will not be a sickly child. He will grow up to be. He will travel to most of the corners of the earth. He will walk with kings. He will be rich and famous. Your name will be carried all over the world. You must not worry about that child." So, for 50 cents, my mother found the support she needed for backing a long shot. She came home and ordered my father to remove the shoebox of a casket from the house. There would be no need for it. And so it followed, for reasons that my mother and I believe were better left unquestioned, that I pulled through. I wasn't a spoiled child. As soon as I was big enough to lift a bucket, I carried water for my mother. I went into the woods to gather bramble to make cooking fire. Even as a toddler, I had my jobs, my purpose, and I knew that I had to contribute to the thin margin of the family's survival. But I was a child bathed in love and attention. My mother wasn't my only guardian angel. One day my sister Teddy said to me, "What are you going to do? What would you like to do when you grow up?" And I remember, at that time I was about 12, I told my sister that I would like to go to Hollywood and become a cowboy. I had just seen my first movie. It was a cowboy movie, of course, and I thought it was the most amazing thing. I had no idea that Hollywood meant the movie business. I thought Hollywood was where they raised cows, and where they used horses to keep the cows corralled, and where the cowboys were the good guys, and they were always fighting the bad guys who were trying to either steal the cows or do something to the people who own the cows, and I wanted to do that kind of work. Teddy laughed, but the laughter wasn't at me. She laughed with me. She was somebody who really loved me a lot, like my mom. She had to be more than 10 years older, and she laughed. I'm sure she must have thought it was so wonderful that I was having this terrific dream, but she didn't correct me. She didn't say, "That's such a way-out fantasy." She didn't say, "Who do you think you are, man? You better get your feet on the ground. Boy, you got a long way to go." No, she obviously had dreams, too. About 10 years later, the family was able to gather in a theater in Nassau to see the first picture I ever made, something called No Way Out. This was in 1950, and for my parents, it was the first time they had ever seen a movie. It must have been something like a fantasy for them, a dream. I'm not entirely sure how much they grasped of the concept. My mother was sitting there, a woman who really didn't know anything about movies. My father was sitting there, a guy who really didn't know anything about movies. The movie played, and they were absolutely enthralled with what they saw, letting go with, "That's my kid," and all that kind of stuff. But near the end of the movie, Richard Widmark pistol whips me in the basement of some house. He's hitting me with this pistol, the butt of this pistol. He's beating the crap out of me with this pistol. And my mother jumps up in the theater and yells, "Hit him back, Sidney! Hit him back! You never did nothing to him!" In front of everybody, my brothers and sisters are squirming and laughing, saying, "Mama, sit down, sit down." But she's not joking. She's for real, completely in the moment. "Hit him back, Sidney, hit him back." Oh, God, that was my mother. That was my mother. There are things that pass through us along the bloodline that don't surface in our children or in our grandchildren. They may not even surface in our great-great-great-grandchildren, but eventually they will surface, you know. If you walk down the street and someone is with you, he'll adjust to your pace or you to his, and you'll never be aware of it. There's no effort. It simply happens. And the same thing can happen with the rhythm of your life. We're connected with everything. We're connected with the primal instincts, and whatever is primal in us goes to the beginning of the species, and back even beyond that. You follow? We carry a sensitivity panel, a panel of connected sensitivity remembrances all passed along through the blood. Because if we are standing or sitting or lying somewhere alive at this moment, then we are living proof that our bloodline is unbroken from the beginning of time. Now, a great prodigy like Mozart, when he can barely walk, finds a piano and he goes over to this instrument, curious, looks at it, tinkers with it, hears some sounds, and in no time is able to begin to make sense of the notes that respond to his touch. And by the age of 3, he's writing symphonies. The music and the instrument simply speak to him. At an organic level, he understands the harmonies and the chord structures. Even before he can even read, he's primed for what he's going to do in his life. But where did it come from? Could it not have come from 10 generations before him, when a child was born with this unbelievable gift, but nobody knew it? It was just there, because nature doesn't place either a prize or a price on such gifts. It simply deposits them, and they can stay dormant in the bloodline for centuries. They don't necessarily have to be passed from father to son, you know? So the primal thing is a very real part of our existence. How do I know that there wasn't a gift for theater or a gift for storytelling in my background 200 years ago, 400 years ago, 700 years ago? Maybe it lay dormant or was momentarily activated and returned to dormancy as it traveled along the bloodline generation after generation. And one day, bingo, it's in a child who walks into a certain place and certain circumstances, and suddenly it comes to life. Now, that could go for musicians, it could go for scientists, it could go for griots in the old days in Africa or the bards in Europe. That's the way it goes because we are all a single human family. The apparatus is the same. All those experiences were registered because there was a consciousness that was taking all that stuff in. Even if it couldn't articulate it or define it, it was just taking that stuff in and responding. There was a response to it. A nervous response, an instinctive response, and that stuff, all that stuff was passed on, and the next generation got it in some form or other, and the next generation after that got it in some form or another, all the way across history. As a matter of fact, it's hard to tell where I came from. Poitiers, obviously, is a French name, given that we were in an English colonial possession, and that Poitiers in the Bahamas is associated only with black people, there's the strong implication that the bearers of that name came from Haiti, the nearest French colonial possession to the Bahamas. We have to assume that my ancestors escaped, because there's no record of a Poitiers family of whites having gone to the Bahamas, so my people left on their own. The other French colonial possessions are way, way, way deep in the Caribbean, and to my mind, it's unlikely that any black people would have migrated all the way across the Caribbean from Martinique or St. Martin's or Guadeloupe into the Bahamas. Speculation is that the family originated in Haiti and moved by escape routes to the Bahamas, settling eventually on Cat Island. Now, mind you, the French in Haiti supported slavery, as did the British colonies. So at the time of my family's migration to the Bahamas, they weren't coming from a slave state to a free state. But Cat Island was such an isolated place that they probably had no difficulty in finding, if not a family to work for, then at least land that they could sharecrop and live on. Cat Island had enormous land area relative to its population. I mean, it was 46 miles long with a population of maybe 100 or 200 white families, you know, and maybe 300 or 400 slaves. So we assume that my ancestors simply started farming, and if anybody bothered to say, by the way, what are you doing on my land, they would have said in French or whatever, we're just here. And then the owner would have said, okay, well, you know, this is my land and you have to give me some of what you produce. My grandfather, Marge Poitiers, wasn't a farmer, though. He was very skilled at building. He would be contracted by the state, by the government, to go to other islands and build a schoolhouse or a government building or some other public structure. That required, first of all, having a boat, which in those days he would have had to build himself. It doesn't appear, according to the oral history of the family, to have been an enormous boat. Rather, it was probably one that took a sail stitched together from the sturdiest canvas cloth he could afford. He most likely made a mast of a tree chopped down in the forest, skinned of bark and fastened in the bow. His rigging rope was either store-bought or handmade. If handmade, it was plaited from sisal, an inhospitable plant with thorn-like edges running along the sides of its leaves and culminating at its end in a point as sharp as a needle. Put in water, the tough skin of the sisal leaf dissolves after some weeks into a strong, stringy, thread-like material that's widely used by those in the rope-making business. My later experience with boats as a young man leads me to say that his boat probably was a 15-footer. It couldn't have been more than an 18-footer. He made a sail because motors were out of the question. You didn't even talk about motors in those days. He would probably have had a couple of oars. In the Caribbean, they row from the stern. He would have had a couple of oars, and he would have had a bailing bucket so that if he ran into difficult weather, he could bail the water out of the boat. Now, crucial to getting a fix on what his character might have been, the places he went to build those houses for the government, they weren't just around the corner. He would have had to sail great distances in open water. For instance, to go from Cat Island to the Exumas by motorboat doing 10, 11 knots an hour is a four-hour run. So, if he was using sail or the oars, you're talking about at least an overnight run. In fact, you're talking about 20 to 25 hours or so in open seas by himself. It's my understanding that his job was to collect local people on site that he would hire to do the job. He was a builder on Cat Island as well, but he was often gone for sometimes months at a time. On one such trip, he was bitten by a black widow spider and took sick on the return trip. By the time he arrived home, he was in very bad shape and died. But Marsh Poitier had a lot of sons and daughters. He had been married before he married my grandmother, with whom he had three children, David, Caroline, and Reggie. Both grandparents on my father's side were dead before I was born, but on my mother's side, I knew Pa Tim and Mama Gina. I knew them because they lived close to us on Cat Island, and they were wonderful, but very old people who were still very much in the old culture. My grandfather, Pa Tim, was a farmer, an extremely tall man who said few words, but he was very close to my grandmother. I remember her better, though. She smoked a pipe and cooked in a thatched hut, and her hair was always tied up with a cloth like a handkerchief, as I recall. And she was very close to her children. She had three daughters, my mother, Evelyn, and another daughter named Yaya, and a daughter named Augusta. My grandmother lived just across the pond from our family. I remember Aunt Yaya, who died before I left for Florida. I remember very well my Aunt Augusta, who also smoked a pipe, the same kind of white clay pipe from the olden days. There was something special in the women of that family. My mother had it, which made my father a very fortunate fellow. Yaya, I recall, having had it too, but Auntie Gusta, it seems to me I saw most of it in Auntie Gusta. Auntie Gusta left her husband Zach because he was abusive. He drank, and whenever he was able to scrounge up enough bucks, he would shell it out on rum. He was a hard-working man, but he spent such monies as he could manage on rum, or he bartered goods, farm products, for rum. And he was an abuser. She only had the courage to leave him once their children were grown. She got on a boat, and she went to Nassau and tried to find a new life for herself. Boy, do you know how much courage that took. That was my mother's family. My mother had a marriage that was unbelievable, and I think it had to do simply with a compatibility that was native to the two personalities. They got along so well. I never heard a cross word. My mother could talk only to my dad, really talk, but they would talk and talk and talk and talk. I mean, they were friends, and they were buddies, and they worked side by side. She respected him, and he, I think, he might have been guilty of a few infractions here and there, He was devoted to her, though, and would never hurt her, never, never, never. You see, he was some years older than Evelyn. Evelyn was 13 when they got married. Reggie, then not quite 30, was the only man she ever knew. In 1936, the state of Florida imposed an embargo against tomatoes grown in the Bahamas. That turn of events would require 32 years to break down Reggie Poitier, and several more to wrestle the life out of him. But the struggle was set in motion mid-morning of a warm, sunny day in 1937, when my mother and I stepped on board a native sailboat. Around us, my father, my older brothers and sisters, and my grandparents on my mother's side all stood or squatted on the jagged coral outcroppings that made up the waterfront of Arthurstown, Cat Island. Behind them, high on a bluff adjacent to the main road, a chorus of cousins, once or twice removed, milled about in a modest crowd of neighbors, friends, and assorted well-wishers. All had come to offer a prayer for our safe passage and wave us goodbye. This was the first step in my father's plan to resettle the family. My mother and I were to travel to Nassau as an advance party to take a look at the lay of the land, search out housing we could afford, and gather such additional information as would be relevant to our survival in an unfamiliar place. The second step, depending on a favorable report, would require the rest of the family to follow in the weeks to come. But on that morning, I was a 10-and-a-half-year-old boy whose thoughts were far from the pressing realities of family survival. While I was old enough to pick up ever so slight changes in my father's face and something unspoken in his eyes, I was still far too young to read or even recognize concerns of obligation when written on a face. Instead, my thoughts roamed freely in a fantasy arena. Weeks before departure time, my imagination had begun running wild with anticipation. When the moment to step on board finally arrived, I was almost too excited, too anxious, too filled with curiosity and wonder about the kind of world I would find beyond the horizon. From rumors, hearsay, and snatches of adult conversations never meant for my ear, I had concluded that whatever world I would find waiting for me must surely be like no place I had ever dreamed of. I had heard that there were real electric lights there, not kerosene lamps like the ones everybody on Cat Island used. Running water inside houses, coming in through pipes from under the ground. With the twist of a little handle, water would come when you want it, as much as you want, as little as you want. I had heard that sworn to as a fact. Yet, how could that be? And more wild than that, cars, they said, were a sight to behold. They said some people, somewhere, in that world beyond the horizon, had made something called a car that would run faster than a horse, which was the fastest thing I knew of. Having never seen a car, I wondered how on earth they managed to make such a thing. And shoes! How about people who had shoes and wore them all the time, not just on Sundays? Even toilets, they say, were found inside some rich people's houses. Couldn't imagine how that would work. As those on shore waved and shouted their goodbyes, the anchor was hoisted, the sail was set, and our vessel eased out to sea. First, the waterfront of Arthurstown grew smaller and smaller. Then Cat Island itself became a dot on which I focused intently until it disappeared from sight. Looking back now in my mind's eye, I remember it as a place where a simple people, 300 families strong, managed their survival through an improvised communal existence. Until the embargo, tomato farming was the closest thing to an industry that we had.